aspect of his new job. "There'll be Indians, but not for a while yet," Cody said, "and I expect they'll mostly want to do their own hair." "I hope so," Ripley said. "You didn't see the Indian on your hunt, did you?" I inquired. Being out on the barren plains always took adjusting to. Part of it was worry that the Indian might appear. What if he was one of those Indians who Cody had said would get the best of him? "What Indian?" Cody asked. I explained about the snowstorms and the lance and Ross Jubb's goggles. Before I could finish, Bill Cody gave one of his big hearty laughs. He even slapped his leg. "That's not an Indian. That's just Mickey. He's Frisian," he said. "Mickey likes to wander around spooking people. I may get him in my Wild West if he'll consent to settling down." At the time, I had no idea what a Frisian was, but I didn't feel like admitting it. Now and then, Bill Cody would chuckle a little as we rode at the ignorance of people who couldn't tell Indians from Frisians. I never mentioned the Indian again. Our time is up for today. I hope you will join me next time when we continue with Telegraph Days by Larry McMurtry. This has been Paul Tavilla for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Are you registered to vote? The last day to register is next Monday, October 5th, for the November 3rd election. In Odessa, register in person at 1010 East 8th Street, Suite 101, or for more information, call 498-4030. In Midland County, applications can be picked up at locations including the Downtown and Centennial Libraries and the Elections and Voter Registration Office. For more, call 688-4890.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 82 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Welcome to your coronavirus update from the Recording Library of West Texas for Monday, October 5th, 2020. I'm Michael, and here are some of the articles and stories that we'll be bringing you this afternoon. Trump was demanding to return to the White House Sunday, sources say. White House physician sows confusion with briefings. Mixed messaging on Trump's health degrades any semblance of stability, says CNN national security analyst. Trump's campaign rocked by COVID-19 in final stretch to Election Day. Senior officials say Trump is engaged in national security. Distrust and conspiracies arise after Trump announced coronavirus diagnosis. Trump's positive coronavirus test upends his campaign strategy and could affect his performance in Texas. Brewster County Health Authority steps down. Officials begin search for replacement. Post-COVID syndrome is a thing. Here's what you need to know about it. Those stories and more coming up this hour. First, we'll check the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,965. Ector County negative, 22,820 out of 28,115 tested, with 300 pending, 100 deaths. Recovered, 4,231. Active, 634. Midland County, 3,913 confirmed cases with 85 deaths. In Texas, average new cases increased by 233 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 4th, 2,181 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations decreased by 25 patients compared with a week ago. As of October 4th, 3,192 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths decreased by 18 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 4th, 33 new deaths were reported. Now, here are coronavirus briefs. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said a decision on whether to discharge Trump will be made after a meeting with doctors Monday at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda. Meadows says he is optimistic Trump will soon return to the White House. With 29 days until the election, an infectious Trump briefly left the hospital Sunday to wave to supporters from a motorcade as confusion continued over the status of his health. Biden tested negative for the third time since he was potentially exposed at Tuesday's presidential debate, his campaign said Sunday night. The former vice president is not yet in the clear, however, because most people incubate the virus for 2 to 14 days before testing positive or showing symptoms. Candidates and debate organizers are pushing ahead with in-person events despite public health concerns. The vice presidential candidates are still scheduled to convene in Salt Lake City for their debate Wednesday. Biden leads Trump by 9 percentage points nationally, 51% to 42%, according to a Washington Post average of polls. Biden's margin is smaller in key states, 7 in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin and Michigan, 5 in Arizona, and 1 in Florida. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany tweeted today that she tested positive for COVID-19 on Monday morning. Pence tests negative again and is still scheduled to head to Salt Lake City. Melania Trump tweets that she is feeling good and will continue to rest at home. Fauci says he doesn't want to comment on Trump's Sunday SUV ride. New Jersey governor calls for federal cooperation on contact tracing following a Trump fundraiser event. Trump campaign advisor says rally protocols won't change after president's coronavirus diagnosis. Positive tests for senators raise doubts about fast-track confirmation of Trump's Supreme Court choice. Here are some short articles. Trump was demanding to return to the White House Sunday, sources say. President Donald Trump was demanding to go back to the White House on Sunday, two sources familiar with the situation told CNN. He is done with the hospital, one of the sources said of Trump's mood yesterday. Trump is concerned the sight of him being hospitalized makes him look weak, the other source said. White House physician sows confusion with briefings. With President Donald Trump battling coronavirus at Walter Reed Medical Center, White House doctor Sean Conley has come under fire for making confusing and misleading comments, including one he later walked back about the president's condition. After Saturday's televised briefing at Walter Reed, a White House official offered more alarming assessment of Trump's health to reporters. That reporting was initially given to a pool of reporters attributed to an official familiar with the president's condition. Later, the Associated Press and the New York Times identified that official as White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Conley claimed at Sunday's briefing that Meadows' widely reported statement contradicting him was misconstrued. The chief and I work side by side, Conley said, and I think his statement was misconstrued. What he meant was that 24 hours ago, when he and I were checking on the president, that was a momentary episode of the high fever and that temporary drop in the saturation, which prompted us to expediently move him up here. Conley added, fortunately, that was really a very transient, limited episode. A couple of hours later, he was back up. Mild again. You know, I'm not going to speculate what that limited episode was about so early in the course, but he's doing well. Conley on Sunday also defended the decision not to disclose that the president was administered oxygen by saying he wanted to reflect the upbeat attitude of the team. I was trying to reflect the upbeat attitude that the team, the president, his course of illness has had. I don't want to give any information that might steer the course of illness in another direction. And in doing so, it came off that we were trying to hide something, Conley said, adding that wasn't necessarily true. Mixed messaging on Trump's health degrades any semblance of stability, says CNN's national security analyst. The White House is shooting themselves in the foot by giving inconsistent and mixed messages about President Donald Trump's health status, CNN national security analyst Samantha Vinograd said on Monday. During crisis times, a core focus for the U.S. government is to send messages about stability. That's to really dissuade malign actors to take advantage of perceived vulnerabilities in the national security apparatus. Vinograd, a former senior advisor to President Barack Obama's National Security Council, told CNN's Michael Holmes. This time around, unfortunately, the team is so incompetent at their communications that they look completely disorganized. They look completely untruthful, and that degrades any semblance of stability the administration might be putting forward. Vinograd added that countries such as China and Russia have been trying to discredit the United States as a competent global leader. But, she said, that's really not a hard sell, based on the president's status and the disorganized approach to communicating the state of his health. Trump's campaign rocked by COVID-19 in final stretch to Election Day. President Trump's campaign has been thrown into chaos, adjusting its tactics, messaging, and work environment following Trump and a number of top aides and political allies' positive tests for coronavirus. Trump is in the hospital. His campaign manager, Bill Stepien, and the Republican National Committee Chair, Rona McDaniel, contracted the virus. All of the campaign's planned rallies and fundraisers featuring the president and his family are on hold. And Trump's ability to debate Democratic rival Joe Biden again is uncertain. Trailing Biden with 1 month left in the 2020 race, Trump is now stuck in a position he spent months trying to avoid. Faced with an election that is all about the coronavirus pandemic, with no way to change the topic. Biden, meanwhile, has committed to getting tested more frequently as he continues in-person campaigning in the final month before Election Day. He is campaigning in Miami Monday, delivering remarks at 3 p.m. focused on the economy and the Hispanic community. With ballots already available in 35 states and voting beginning in the swing states of Arizona, Iowa, New Hampshire, and Ohio within the next week, millions of votes could be cast with Trump sick with the virus he has downplayed for months. The next time Trump and Biden are scheduled to meet in person for a debate is October 15th for a town hall-style event in Miami, but it's unclear now whether Trump will be physically able to participate. The Commission on Presidential Debates is already preparing to make a change that is effectively a rebuke of Trump, whose guests declined a Cleveland Clinic doctor's request that they wear masks at the first debate on Tuesday. A source familiar with the matter said the commission will announce that everyone in the debate halls, except the candidates and moderator, must remain masked until conclusion, and those not wearing masks will be escorted out. Senior officials say Trump is engaged on national security issues. A pair of senior Trump administration officials sought Monday to portray Trump as fully engaged on national security during his time being treated for the novel coronavirus at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda. In a radio interview, National Security Advisor Robert C. O'Brien described a briefing on Sunday in which he and several other officials, including Vice President Pence, spoke with Trump by phone. "We were able to give him a brief and take him around the world on every issue that we're facing from a foreign policy, national security front," O'Brien told syndicated radio host Hugh Hewitt. "He was incredibly engaged. He had advice and laid out what his policies were to the team." An official traveling with Defense Secretary Mark T. Esper, who also took part in the call, relayed a similar message to reporters traveling overseas with Esper. Esper said the president sounded good and was very engaged, asking tough questions during the roughly 30-minute call, the official said. Voter registration deadline is today. How to ensure you can vote in Texas on Election Day. If you want to vote in the upcoming elections, it's time to make sure your affairs are in order. Monday is the deadline to register to vote in Texas in the November 3rd local and national elections, including the races for president and congressional and legislative seats. Here are five things you need to know about getting on the voter rolls and making sure your registration is correct and up to date. Find out if you are already registered, and check to be sure your address is correct to ensure you get the right ballot on Election Day. 2. If not registered, get an application. Many local libraries, government establishments, and high schools have applications available that you can fill out and mail in. You can also download an application online and mail it in. Just make sure it's postmarked before today's registration deadline. You can also register in person at the county elections office. 3. Fill out the application. You must be 17 years and 10 months old on the day you apply, and you must be at least 18 years old on election day to vote. Be sure to read the application and fill it out completely. 4. Check your voter registration card. After successfully applying to register, your voter registration card will be mailed to you within 30 days. If there are any mistakes on your card, return it to your voter registrar office immediately. You'll need ID. When voting day arrives, you'll need to present one of 7 accepted forms of identification at the polls, such as a Texas driver's license or identification card, a U.S. passport, or a military photo ID. Don't have any of those? You can fill out a form at the polls and present supporting forms of identification, such as a current paycheck, bank statement, utility bill, or your original birth certificate. Here's an article now from the Washington Post. Just how sick is Trump? Washington eager for details amid conflicting messages from White House. At the White House, the world is watching. All of Washington is trying to figure out how sick President Trump really is. Many questions about the president's condition and the administration's handling of the coronavirus outbreak within his own orbit remain unanswered as the White House offers contradictory information about the status of his health. The White House has thus painted an incomplete picture of the situation that required Trump to be admitted to Walter Reed National Medical Center on Friday. They gave notice that Trump has begun steroid treatment, usually reserved for patients with severe illness, and that he suffered twice from bouts of low oxygen. Yet Trump and his medical team contend that he is doing well and could be discharged from Walter Reed as soon as today. Piling on to the confusion. Trump defied public health guidelines and briefly left the hospital to wave at his supporters from a motorcade parade to visit his supporters. Trump's impromptu breach of quarantine, derided as cavalier by doctors and Secret Service, underscored open questions about the current health of the moderately obese 74-year-old who is being treated with the range of experimental therapies. An admission by White House doctor Sean Conley is fueling criticism of a lack of transparency. Trump's medical team tried to clear up the muddled picture it had created the previous day when White House doctor Sean Conley falsely suggested that Trump had not been given supplemental oxygen. Conley openly admitted to withholding truthful information about Trump's plummeting blood oxygen levels Friday, indicating he did so to put a positive spin on the president's improving condition. The reasoning. I was trying to reflect the upbeat attitude that the team, the president, that his course of illness has had, Conley said Sunday. I didn't want to give any information that might steer the course of illness in another direction. And in doing so, you know, it came off that we were trying to hide something which wasn't necessarily true. Zooming out, the episode continued what has been a days-long torrent of falsehoods, obfuscation, evasion, misdirection, and imprecision from those surrounding Trump as he faces the greatest threat to a president's health in decades. The confusion has penetrated the halls of the White House, too. Not even Trump administration staffers trust what they're hearing about the state of Trump's health, despite being potentially exposed to the virus as well. I can tell you what I'm hearing, and I honestly have no idea if it's right. One senior administration official close to the president told our colleagues Suen Min Kim, Josh Dawsey, and Colby Eichowitz on Saturday. A lot of people aren't even telling other people in the building the truth. I'm glued to Twitter and TV because I have no official communication from anyone in the West Wing, an administration official told the Wall Street Journal's Michael Bender and Rebecca Bauhaus. The next clue. Whether Trump is actually released today. For a coronavirus patient admitted Friday to be sent home Monday would be remarkably atypical. Robert Walcher, chairman of the University of California at San Francisco's Department of Medicine, told Toulouse, Josh, and Amy from the Washington Post. For someone sick enough to have required remdesivir and dexamethasone, I can't think of a situation in which a patient would be okay to leave on day three, even with the White House's medical capacity. Medical infectious disease experts say the medical details released suggest a more severe case of COVID-19 than his physicians acknowledged, per the New York Times' Katie Thomas and Roni Karen Rabin. Trump's oxygen levels dropped to a level that can indicate that a patient's lungs are compromised, and the steroid dexamethasone may even be risky for those who have milder forms of the disease. Suddenly, they're just throwing the kitchen sink at him. Thomas McGinn, physician-in-chief at Northwell Health, the largest healthcare provider in New York State, told The Times. It raises the question, is he sicker than we're hearing, or are they being overly aggressive because he is the president, in a way that could be potentially harmful? More from the New York Times. Some experts raised an additional possibility, that the president is directing his own care and demanding intense treatment despite risks he may not fully understand. The pattern even has a name, VIP syndrome, which describes prominent figures who receive poor medical care because doctors are too zealous in treating them or defer too readily to their instructions. Concerns about a politically motivated release. Even some of Trump's aides are concerned that Conley will release Trump from the hospital too early. Trump, who historically hates hospitals and anything related to illness, has been hankering to get released, according to two people close to him, and some aides expressed fears that he would pressure Dr. Conley into releasing him by claiming to feel better than he actually does, the New York Times' Peter Baker and Maggie Haberman report. But advisors were also troubled by the doctor's prediction that they might release him on Monday, because if they do not, it would signal that the president is not doing as well as indicated. They also worried that a premature return could lead to a second trip to the hospital if his condition worsens. Trump's brief hospital break is likely to drive further criticism that he is throwing coronavirus precautions to the wind. At this point, the president and senior people around him have violated all five core principles of the country's coronavirus strategy, Tom Bossert, Trump's former Homeland Security advisor, told Toulouse, Josh, and Amy of the Washington Post. I do not wish to be perceived as criticizing him while he is in this condition, but that needs to be pointed out. I am praying for his recovery. The attending physician at Walter Reed. Tweet from Dr. James P. Phillips, M.D. Every single person in the vehicle during that completely unnecessary presidential drive-by just now has to be quarantined for 14 days. They might get sick, they may die. For political theater, commanded by Trump to put their lives at risk for theater. This is insanity. Don't tell anyone. The president's prognosis has brought the White House's credibility crisis to a head. The secrecy appears to have been by the president's design, with just under 30 days until the election, and fresh polling indicating Trump is trailing Democratic nominee Joe Biden by 14 points nationally since the debate. President Trump didn't disclose a positive result from a rapid test for COVID-19 on Thursday, while awaiting the findings from a more thorough coronavirus screening, according to people familiar with the matter, the Wall Street Journal's Bender and Bauhaus report. Mr. Trump received a positive result on Thursday evening before making an appearance on Fox News in which he didn't reveal those results. Trump urged his staff to keep a close hold on the spread of the virus among his circle, too. As the virus spread among the people closest to him, Mr. Trump also asked one advisor not to disclose results of their own positive test. "Don't tell anyone," Mr. Trump said, according to a person familiar with the conversation. Trump's own campaign manager, Bill Stepien, didn't know that Hope Hicks, one of the president's closest White House aides, had tested positive on Thursday morning until news reports later that evening, according to a person familiar with the matter. The Trump campaign said Friday evening that Mr. Stepien had tested positive. this isn't the first time the White House has not been forthcoming with details about the president's health. In preparing for this book, I learned that in the hours leading up to Trump's trip to the hospital in November 2019, word went out in the West Wing for the vice president to be on standby to take over the powers of the presidency temporarily if Trump had to undergo a procedure that would have required him to be anesthetized. New York Times reporter Michael Schmidt writes in his book, Donald Trump versus the United States, Inside the Struggle to Stop a President. Vice President Pence never assumed the powers of the presidency, and the reason for Trump's trip to the doctor remains a mystery, Schmidt adds. White House Correspondents Association criticized the decision to leave the hospital without notifying the journalists assigned to cover his every move. The WHCA on President Trump's decision today. It is outrageous for the president to have left the hospital, even briefly, amid a health crisis, without a protective pool present to ensure that the American people know where their president is and how he is doing. Details we don't know. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany declined to disclose when Trump last tested negative before the debate, citing privacy concerns. That detail would help those potentially exposed. In contrast, Biden's team announced on Saturday evening that the campaign will announce the results of every coronavirus test that the former vice president takes, our colleague Annie Linksy reports. Biden tested negative on Sunday for the third time since he shared the debate stage with Trump and is slated to travel to Florida on Monday for an NBC town hall. Information has been scarce for those potentially caught in the White House outbreak, too. 90% of the White House complex most certainly learned about it in the news, as has been the case ever since, a senior White House official told New York Magazine's Olivia Nuzzi and Ben Jacobs on Saturday. There are reports that COVID is spreading like wildfire through the White House. There are hundreds and hundreds of people who work on complex, some who have families with high-risk family members. Since this whole thing started, not one email has gone out to tell employees what to do or what's going on. The White House staff finally received an email with instructions about the outbreak on Sunday evening, telling them not to come to work if they have symptoms. If they develop them, they're told to go home and contact their primary care provider, CNN's Caitlin Collins reports. Staff should not go to the White House Medical Unit Clinic for any COVID-19 testing inquiries, the note read. But Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, has yet to deliver guidance to the president's aides about how they were expected to behave in a moment of crisis, per the New York Times' Annie Carney. The people. Superspreading. By Saturday, there was still little evidence that the White House has distributed guidance to the hundreds of people potentially exposed to the coronavirus or began contact tracing efforts to limit coronavirus exposure. Trump mingled with more than 200 people at his New Jersey Gold Club for a campaign fundraiser just hours before he tested positive for the coronavirus. Less than a week before that, he welcomed 150 political allies and religious leaders, including several who are now infected, to the White House to meet the jurist he has nominated to the Supreme Court. In between, the president met with dozens of aides without wearing a mask, even in close quarters, and after top aide Hope Hicks had tested positive. He appeared before thousands at a rally in Minnesota, and he held a nationally televised debate with former Vice President Joe Biden after holding up with debate preppers, our colleagues Josh Dawsey, Yasmin Abdulab, Isaac Stanley Becker, and Joel Achenbach report. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had a contact tracing team ready to go, according to multiple sources, but had not been asked to mobilize, even though Conley said at a press briefing that his team was working with the agency. Our colleagues Josh Dawsey, Yasmin Abdulab, Isaac Stanley Becker, and Joel Achenbach report. Conley also said he was coordinating with local health agencies, but officials in Minnesota, Ohio, and New Jersey, where Trump held events in recent days, said they haven't heard from the White House and are racing largely on their own to find people potentially exposed to the virus. Court Watch. Last week, the President and First Lady Melania Trump, who also tested positive for the virus, welcomed more than 150 guests to the White House Rose Garden to formally introduce Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett to Republican members of the Judiciary Committee in attendance, Mike Lee of Utah, who hugged and mingled with guests, and Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, both tested positive for the virus. This may throw off the tight timeline of Barrett's confirmation process. Sensing an opportunity to delay, Democrats are cranking up their push to postpone the October 12th confirmation hearings, citing the safety of members, aides, and Barrett herself, waging a public pressure campaign because they have no powers on their own to stop the proceedings, our colleague Seung-Min Kim reports. Senate Majority Leader Charles E. Schumer, Democrat, New York, is demanding that all members get tested before a hearing, per a statement he provided to the Post. Moving forward with the committee process when three senators have recently tested positive for COVID-19 is irresponsible and dangerous, but doing so without requiring all members to be tested before a hearing in accordance with CDC best practices would be intentionally reckless, Schumer said. If Chairman Lindsey Graham doesn't require testing, it may make some wonder if he just doesn't want to know the results. Democrats are also eyeing their real opening, when GOP votes are needed to advance Barrett's nomination in the committee and on the floor, and a critical mass of Republican senators remain positive for the novel coronavirus or in isolation when their in-person presence would be needed, per Seung-Min. The campaign. Trump campaign halted at tricky time. October was supposed to be the turnaround month. After trailing Democratic nominee Joe Biden all year, Trump thought this past week would be his slingshot to securing a second term by disqualifying his opponent at their first debate together, expanding his coalition of voters, raising more money, and staging bigger rallies, Philip Rooker, Josh Dawsey, and Annie Linksy report. Privately, Trump aides acknowledged the struggle. Anytime the conversation is about coronavirus, it's not helpful for us, a senior administration official said. Aides also say Trump's hospitalization undercuts what he views as his main attribute over Biden, that he appears stronger and tougher, our colleagues write. The Biden campaign has taken down its negative ads, but don't expect any major changes. His strategy to model best practices with the pandemic has drawn some criticism for being low energy and casual, as if cosseting the candidate. But Biden's advisors see recent developments as affirming, our colleagues write. At the end of the day, we've made a fundamental decision to model what a president should do, senior advisor Anita Dunn said. Health experts nervous about debates. The vice presidential candidates are still scheduled to convene in Salt Lake City on Wednesday, despite last week's presidential debate, resulting in at least 11 positive cases by people involved in preparations, and one of the candidates on stage testing positive just 2 days later, Michael Shearer reports. This time, the candidates will be a little further apart. They will be situated about 12 feet from each other, an increase from the planned 7-foot separation, our colleague writes. The change was made after Trump's positive coronavirus test. But that arrangement is not virus-proof. The arrangement meets federal health guidelines but does not rule out transmission of the virus between the two candidates, given the possibility of aerosol spread, say public health experts. Nor does it ensure that others gathering for the event will be free of danger, our colleague wrote. A key quote, "I don't understand why we are still having these in person. We could put them in separate rooms, put it on Zoom," Tara C. Smith, an epidemiologist and professor at Kent State University's College of Public Health, told our colleagues, especially for the current vice president. We don't know what is happening with the president. A remote debate is not unprecedented. Is it really necessary to put two vice presidential candidates in the same studio at this dangerous time? In their third 1960 debate, Richard Nixon was in Los Angeles and John Kennedy in New York, written by Michael Belchloff in a tweet. The debate itself is receiving increased focus. Trump's diagnosis with a potentially lethal virus and the fact he is 74 and Biden is 77 was a stark reminder that either Vice President Pence or Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat California, could end up being president themselves, as opposed to just leading contenders for the nomination in 2024 and beyond, the Times' Adam Negrini and Shane Goldmacher report. What's at stake? For Pence, the debate will most likely compel him to account for the administration's record on a virus that has now infected 7.4 million Americans, including the most protected man in the country, Trump, an answer for his own stewardship as chairman of the Federal Coronavirus Task Force. For Harris, a former prosecutor, the debate is a chance to show that she is capable of being president in a national emergency, as well as to demonstrate that she can challenge the Trump record on COVID-19 without seeming overly aggressive against an ailing president. Outside the Beltway, cases are rising in parts of the country. About two-thirds of all U.S. states reported an uptick in new coronavirus cases in the last week, according to data tracked by the Washington Post, indicating that colder temperatures in much of the country may be driving people indoors and helping to spread the virus. What's happening? Several states in the once hard-hit Northeast were among those posting their largest new case counts in months, but many of the sharpest increases per capita came in the Midwest and Mountain West, including states like Wisconsin, Iowa, Utah, and the Dakotas. On the Hill. Relief deal still not in sight. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said there is no deal yet on a new coronavirus relief package as Democrats wait to see whether the Trump administration will agree to terms, Erica Werner reports. Where things stand. Negotiations continued over the weekend, but there was little sign of a breakthrough that would be imminent. Pelosi asked airlines on Friday to hold off impending furloughs of tens of thousands of workers pending a deal. United and American, the major carriers that have threatened furloughs, have said they can reverse them if there is a deal to extend payroll support for the industry that just expired, but Congress must act fast. Now we'll go to our first pre-recorded report today. From NPR, distrust and conspiracies arise after Trump announced coronavirus diagnosis.
It was hours before dawn Friday when the president tweeted that he had tested positive for the coronavirus, and the conspiracy theories did not wait for the sun. They came from the right and the left, examples of a general waning of public trust in who and what to believe. That, as people are already voting. Clint Watts is a disinformation expert with the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You listed dangers to the election back in July. Number one was mail-in ballot conspiracies and threats to delay the election based on mail-in voting. And we've seen that coming from the president himself. But number two was that the candidates contracted the coronavirus, possibly. Now that has happened. So first, let me say you were incredibly prescient. Is the reaction playing out as you thought it would?
Yes, it is. But I would say that in terms of volume, it's huge, but everyone, in terms of their preferred conspiracy, is taking a tack that is somewhat predictable. By that, I mean, if you went to QAnon circles, which is probably the largest volume of conspiracies that you'll see on social media, they see it, this is some sort of a plan by the president where he is going into hiding. They try and read clues into it. For those that are supportive of Trump, they claim that the president contracted this from Joe Biden and the Democrats. And if, for those that are anti-Trump, it's really about he's hiding this as part of a secret plot or to distract from other problems he had with his tax records or the debate and the Proud Boys. And so It's interesting that everyone has a conspiracy about this illness, but it really tracks with what they were already saying about the president or what they already wanted to believe.
What kind of activity are you seeing online in reaction to the president's health and conditions? I mean, is it a big volume of discussion?
It's an enormous volume of discussion. And I think part of that volume comes from how we have proceeded over this last 4 years, where we've lost trust in institutions, expertise, science, and doctors, to where I think anyone, even if they wanted to refute conspiracies, like myself, doesn't have a truth to point to. We don't have data or facts that we can actually use to combat conspiracies. And the delays coming out of the White House make these proliferate even more. The longer there is between when something happens and the truth and facts come out, the more conspiracies tend to spread.
Because, as you mentioned, and as we've heard, there is a lot of confusion coming out of this White House. And, of course, even the fact-based media is having to sort of scramble to figure out what's going on.
Yes, we saw that yesterday with Walter Reed, the press conference there, then the discussions, you know, immediately after, wanting more details about what happened before he got to Walter Reed. And there's really not many answers. And you'll hear shifting messages out of the White House about the president's condition. This brings conspiracies. One of the biggest ones overnight was the president on oxygen or not? And there's no definitive answer about that. And so that leads to more and spiraling and iterations of conspiracies that it just becomes really hard to know what to believe. If the president were doing well, how would we know? How can we confirm that? And if he were to be doing poorly, would we know? I think that's what everyone's trying to solve at this point, and the media is struggling after 4 years of this onslaught of kind of disinformation and misinformation.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you seen any evidence of foreign actors getting involved, Russian bots, or is this just really a symptom of a polarized and suspicious America?
It's overwhelmingly American-made this time. You will see the Russians talk about it, and actually they're taking a tone of snark. President Putin offered a very supportive message publicly, but they also offered the vaccine to the president should he ask for it. It was kind of a tongue-in-cheek sort of push at the president getting COVID. And from China, they prefer stability, so they try and take a longer tack. They're waiting to see what the truth is, and I'm not sure that they really know how to pivot. So it's overwhelmingly domestic, not so much foreign so far.
Are you worried that that could change?
I think it will change over time. There's got to be enough. You know, they have to know what narrative they want to advance, and they also have to know what the audience is they want to direct. And so as the election heats up, I would expect Russia to really use this sort of as attack against Joe Biden and to try and say that Biden took the election or is trying to take the election or tried to demobilize the president. I expect that to come out of the Russian fringe community.
Clint Watts is a disinformation expert with the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Little surprise that on this Friday, one of the top trending searches in the U.S. is Trump and COVID. The president is reportedly experiencing cold-like symptoms after testing positive for the coronavirus. The vice president and secretary of state have both tested negative. In a political memo, Matt Flegenheimer writes for the New York Times that President Trump's health news brought on for many the kind of psychic doom spiraling that has felt endemic to the era. Though President Trump's critics and opponents may feel a certain schadenfreude, given the president's apparent disdain for mask using and efforts to downplay the concerns of some of his own health experts. There's little doubt this news has the potential to transform the political landscape only days before the first in-person ballots are cast in Texas. But how? Joining us now, Todd Gilman, bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, welcome back to the Standard.
Sure thing.
Folks in D.C., those in the White House press corps who've been traveling with the president, shocked by this news?
Shocked? No, because we've all seen a fairly cavalier attitude among the White House staff and the president towards social distancing and mask wearing. I actually remember early on in March, I happened to be at a White House press briefing, and I asked the president, who was standing next to the vice president, do you really think that's such a great idea? What if one of you catches it? Have you thought about maybe staying away from each other? And they absolutely poo-pooed that concern. They are, in fact, staying separate now. But the idea that aides would get on Marine One, which is a very tight quarters with the president, nobody wearing a mask, it's almost inevitable. And so the White House press corps is not shocked that this happened, because we've seen the behaviors that would almost inevitably lead to an outbreak in the West Wing.
How does this affect the political landscape now in this most consequential general election? I know that the president had some rallies scheduled, for example. This has got to affect his calendar, his campaign calendar, and that's just for starters.
It does, and the implications are only just beginning to come into focus. So the president on Friday night was supposed to do a rally outside of Orlando, Florida, obviously a huge battleground. He had two rallies in Wisconsin on Saturday. He has rallies scheduled through Tuesday in Nevada and Arizona and California. And it turns out he was even going to be campaigning in Houston next week, which they hadn't announced until one of those autopilot emails, come join me in Houston, hit inboxes this morning. And Texas, you know, is a battleground. It may be teetering. And without the president being able to do what he does best, which is rally the crowds and thrill his supporters and bring out many, many thousands of people to these airport rallies, it's hard to imagine how he gets his enthusiasm up. For him to catch COVID, particularly a month before Election Day, which is extraordinary. We've never had a U.S. president sidelined a month before Election Day by any illness, let alone a highly contagious pathogen. But President Trump's entire way of campaigning is built on having these crowds. He just doesn't want to do it. He refused to not do it. In total contrast to Joe Biden, who has socially distanced, and Trump has mocked him for these low-energy, small gatherings where everyone's seated far apart wearing masks. Trump is going to have to turn on a dime and figure out, assuming that he remains healthy enough to do anything, which we all, of course, hope that he does. He just is not in a pattern of campaigning other than in public in front of large crowds. It's going to be an enormous challenge for him.
We don't have much time, but you mentioned Houston, and I wonder how this moves the political needle in the Lone Star State, which already, I mean, Alan West, the new head of the Texas Republican Party, was asking Trump to come down the day before Election Day as sort of a signal that Republicans are concerned about support for Trump here in the Lone Star State.
That is an enormous signal. And as I say, I think we're only just beginning to see how this impacts the race in Texas for congressional seats, for control of the state house, and even for the White House, because it's really game over for Republicans if they can't hold Texas in the presidential contest. I would say that without Trump's ability to do these big airport rallies or outdoor rallies, I think that seriously impedes his ability to generate enthusiasm. And the fact that he has been so cavalier about masks and that he downplayed the danger of the coronavirus for so long, and he really bet his reelection on projecting strength and economic recovery, and a lot of that hinged on him being in public without a mask. And this completely undermines the argument that America's on the comeback because, look, I can go out and talk to people all the time, and if not exactly press the flesh, something pretty close to it. It really upends the whole narrative of this campaign.
This is a developing story, one that Todd Gilman continues to cover as D.C. Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to his latest, TexasStandard.org. Todd, thanks.
Sure thing.
Now, closer to home as we move to other news. From Marfa Public Radio, Brewster County Health Authority steps down. Officials begin search for replacement.
This is Marfa Public Radio. I'm Ari Snyder. At the beginning of this week, Brewster County's local health authority, Dr. Ekta Escobar, formally stepped down from that role, which she's held since earlier this year. In that time, her work included guiding the region's response to the pandemic, helping the county maintain its daily dashboard of cases and hospitalizations, and also helping with contact tracing. So without a public health authority, what's next for the Big Bend region? Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales has been looking into these questions and is here to help us out. Carlos, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, happy to do it.
So Dr. Escobar has stepped down from her role as public health authority. What else do we know, and why is this happening now?
Yeah, well, from what Dr. Escobar has told colleagues and the people she worked with on the task force that I've spoken with, you know, her role as the local health authority kind of just became a lot to juggle. You know, she's first and foremost a pediatrician. You know, that's what she's been doing ever since she moved out here to far west Texas and started working at Big Bend Regional Medical Center. And, you know, considering all the work this unpaid position asks of a person, you know, like all those things you mentioned, Ari, you know, leading the region's coronavirus response, maintaining the daily dashboard, it becomes a lot, and especially when you already have, you know, little extra time to begin with.
So without a local health authority, what happens next and who fills this role?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something we don't, you know, have a complete answer for yet. The Department of State Health Services, which is the state agency that will directly communicate with the local health authority about, you know, the latest guidance or practices, confirmed cases, that agency says that the regional medical doctor will now take on this role. So for us out here, that's Dr. Rachel Sani. She's based out of El Paso, and the state tells me that she will communicate directly now with our county judge. So that's Elias Arcano. And she'll also talk with other appropriate local officials. Now, I did reach out to Judge Cano a few times about, you know, all of this, but haven't heard back from him yet. But he did tell the Alpine Avalanche that eventually he feels it'll be important to have another local doctor fill the role of local health authority. You know, someone who has a sense of what's happening here on, you know, a local community-based level. There's reportedly a search underway for that person right now, but we'll see, you know, when that announcement happens and who gets selected.
Gotcha. So Carlos, I saw Cano's statement as well, and it does sound like it'll be difficult to fill this role. I think he called the job a, quote, delicate position to be in. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, from the outside, it doesn't seem to be a position that's easy at all. You know, one of the other public health authorities I spoke with recently called it a thankless job. You know, the workload, as we talked about, Ari, of course, is heavy. But you also become the very public figure behind, you know, safety measures during a pandemic, right? And those are messages that have, unfortunately, become lightning rods for online trolls, people saying hateful, vitriolic things. And that is something that Cano himself acknowledged. You know, in that statement, you know, you were referring to, you know, he said that this is a delicate position. It's one that allows you to provide help, but it's also one, you know, he said that makes you a target for, quote, negative feedback. And since March, there's been a vocal crowd here in the region that's opposing shutdowns, that's against any requirements for face coverings or any pandemic precautions. And, you know, it's not just happening here. It's something we've seen or heard of across the country. And that's health authorities becoming targets of hateful speech, people calling into question their credentials, their professionalism. And, you know, I can really imagine that it becomes disheartening. So when Judge Cano says that this is a delicate position to be in, I think he's talking about, you know, all of these things that we're seeing happening here in Brewster County and across the country where health authorities are targets for some pretty hateful things.
Yeah, that does sound like a really tough and pretty unfortunate position to be in. So, Carlos, without an LHA, this local health authority, what are we going without? Like, how does this impact day-to-day life?
Yeah, there are a few things I would say there, Ari. I think one, you know, Dr. Escobar was instrumental in putting together Brewster County's daily coronavirus dashboard, and that was something that was shared on the county's Facebook page, you know, and like every morning at like about 11 or maybe even noon, you know, we got updates on the latest information on confirmed cases, test results, hospitalizations, you know, et cetera. And right now, since Escobar has stepped down from this role, that dashboard hasn't been updated since September 26th. And it was a key measure of how Brewster County is doing. You know, if there's a spike in cases, are we kind of on the edge of an outbreak? And right now it's unclear who updates that in the immediate or if it goes away altogether.
Gotcha. And we'll, of course, be following the story, seeing what happens next. Carlos Morales is a reporter here at Marfa Public Radio. Carlos, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, no problem, Ari.
Now from the Texas Standard, post-COVID syndrome is a thing. Here's what you need to know about it.
As you probably heard said hundreds of times by now, there's a lot we're still learning about COVID-19. It's new, literally a novel coronavirus. And we've only known its existence for less than a year, so that means one big thing we don't yet know is its long-term effects. But as time goes on, doctors are getting a better idea of how the disease affects some people in the months after they've gotten sick. For thousands of people, It's become a chronic condition known as post-COVID syndrome. For more, we turn to Dr. Esther Melamed. She is an assistant professor in the neurology department at UT Austin's Dell Medical School. Dr. Melamed, thanks for your time. We welcome you to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
What does post-COVID syndrome look like, and how long does it last?
So what we're seeing now, David, is that people who have been sick with COVID, some of them, up to about a third of people who had had COVID, continue to have symptoms such as headaches or very severe fatigue, muscle pains, trouble with their mood, and other symptoms for weeks or months, even after their initial infection. And these people are now getting a name that's called long haulers because of these persistent symptoms.
If you are a long hauler, is it possible you no longer actually carry the virus? In other words, you're not infectious or anything along those lines, but you're still suffering symptoms?
Very much so, David. Our immune system is able to fight off the virus, but there may be long-lasting symptoms because of the inflammatory response that continues on even after the virus has been cleared from the body.
Does it stand to reason that people who have the most serious signs or effects of the coronavirus are those who tend to have chronic symptoms, symptoms that linger?
That does seem to be the case, that people who have had more severe illness may have more difficulty recovering in the long term. For example, people who had been in the ICU and had lung damage or heart damage may have persistent difficulties for several months. And that's something that can happen with many other viral infections or other serious medical conditions. At post-ICU care, it takes people some time to recover. However, there are also studies suggesting that people with even mild symptoms may go on to have persistent symptoms and not quite be able to go back to their baseline after they've cleared the virus and the PCR is negative.
Not go back ever? I mean, is it possible that some people with these long-lasting symptoms might never fully recover from COVID-19?
We don't know that. We will definitely need to continue to monitor. This is a novel virus. We haven't seen one quite like it. However, there definitely is evidence from other viral infections like H1N1 epidemic. We saw that, for example, in kids, for some time after the infection, there were neurological complications like seizures after that kind of virus. And for some, that resolved. For a virus like SARS-CoV-1, so the first SARS virus, there are studies looking out at 2 years showing that people may have persistent lung symptoms. But it is definitely, we don't know.
So at this juncture, what is job one as doctors try to get some answers to these longer term effects? What's next in terms of what you're looking for and how you're going about that?
We are monitoring people for improvement in their underlying symptoms, but also keeping really a keen eye on any other emerging symptoms and trying to see if there may be emergence of new conditions. So we're definitely seeing emergence of diabetes and emergence of high blood pressure and autoimmune diseases, both Kawasaki-like disease in kids, as well as demyelinating diseases in adults. And it is certainly, we're on the lookout for, we're doing lab studies to try to identify if there are new emerging diagnoses for patients. Are there new endocrine abnormalities? Are there new infections that people could be co-infected with when they get the virus? You know, we're heading into the flu season now, and the recommendation that I give to my patients is to be on the lookout for new symptoms to make sure that people are continuing to manage their diseases that they had prior to COVID. And we're doing our best to identify these diagnoses and to treat.
Dr. Esther Melamed is an assistant professor at UT Austin's Dell Medical School in the neurology department. Dr. Melamed, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, David.
Finally today, for a historical perspective, here's a report from the Texas Standard. Donald Trump, and Woodrow Wilson, U.S. presidents who did not escape a global pandemic.
President Trump is being treated for COVID-19 at Walter Reed Hospital. The data that we have about COVID suggests odds are good the president will come through this just fine. History, of course, tells us that there are no sure things. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie says this isn't the first time an American president has become infected with a novel virus that sickened the world.
In April 1919, President Woodrow Wilson was in Paris negotiating